Hello, everybody. Welcome to a new episode of ESAR podcast. I am Hasan Umut. Today, I'm very privileged to host Adrian Bejan, professor of mechanical engineering at Duke University. Well, actually, he needs no introduction in his field because he is one of the most influential scientists worldwide, specializing in thermodynamics, heat transfer, convection, design and evolution in nature. He is the author or co-author of 30 books and more than 600 articles, and he received many prestigious awards and grants. So today we will be talking about his latest book entitled Time and Beauty, Why Time Flies and Beauty Never Dies, which was recently published just 1 month before. So in the beginning, I should say that this book is a very thought-provoking book written with an interdisciplinary approach. Also, I should say we are going to talk this with Professor Bejan, but in the beginning, I would like to say also this one. So I think in this book, we have two Adrian Bejans in conversation, in dialogue. The scientist, Adrian Bejan, who uses his scientific publications to propose theoretical approaches to time, beauty, design, and nature. And the other one is the intellectual, Adrian Bejan, who proposes new ideas and emphasizes proposing new ideas, of course, by using many scientific theories, discoveries, as well as by drawing on the history of science, art, and humanities. So without further ado, first let me say welcome, Professor Bejan. Thank you very much for accepting our invitation.
Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you so much. So let me start with a general question. So before diving into the details of your book, so as we see in your book, you have an interdisciplinary approach. So you like to go through different disciplines. So what makes you motivate to deal with subjects at the intersection of the natural and social sciences, as well as humanities and even philosophy?
Well, I don't know the answer to that. The creative flow is what you know yourself from your own work. Things just occur to you, and it's just like the ball that somebody sends you on the fast break. So you have to run after it and catch the ball and then score. You don't think about these things that you mentioned. If it is a good idea, you pounce on it and enjoy the search for the answer, and yes, if that is the phenomenon of let's call it happiness and intellectual work, then you don't worry about disciplines or labels or what other people think. You're in this game alone. You with your feelings and your imagination first, and then the satisfaction of having discovered something that is worth telling other people. That's the life of the intellectual. Now the labels that you bring up are today's language, today. Higher education is in the very tiny compartments. You introduced me as a mechanical engineer. Well, that happens to be written on my diplomas, but the truth about I would say most of us in academia is that each of us has a PhD. Which means a doctor of a philosophy, which means philosophy means love of or lover of wisdom. and doctor means teacher. And these ancient labels are non-denominational. They're for everybody who likes to think about ideas and then to explore them and then to tell other people useful things. So, in fact, your opening question is what unites us, what makes us all the same, meaning belong to the same group. Contrary to the impression given by the labels are divisive. The fact that we come together to discuss ideas is the unifying force, and in fact, the reality of scientific work and progress.
That part of your life, you like basketball a lot, and you use a lot of examples in your book. So it's also another part of your, so to speak, interdisciplinary understanding. Well, as you said, we like labels, but we need to look at beyond them. And actually, what you do in your book is this, right? So you are looking at time and beauty from a different perspective, because when we talk about beauty, it's more philosophical. We are tended to think it as a philosophical or artistic phenomena, but you show that it has a physical dimension. So could you please tell us how you define time and beauty?
Sure. Both are measurable. Time means change. Time means the observation that what you're looking at is different than it different now than it was, than the way it looked before. Time, by the way, goes hand in hand with the concept of evolution, change after change after change, also known as the direction of time, is evolution. Provided that the sequence of changes impress us with a particular direction. The direction, according to the constructive law, is toward the changes that offer greater access to what moves and what flows in those moving images. So that's the physics of time. The physics of beauty it also has to do with the human perception of the image. Turns out that that the image is actually transmitted to the brain initially as a sequence of snapping movements called saccade, in other words, clicks that the eyes are executing at the high frequency. And the eyes, therefore, are scanning the image in those two directions, horizontally and vertically. And so the image or the page is scanned the fastest if it has a particular shape. And that shape is what the computer screen is showing us today. It is the same shape as that of the business card and the banknote, the flag of a nation, all these things, the cinema screen, all these things that we take for granted and we do not question. Now, an image that is scanned faster than other images is more attractive because it gives the observer a better chance of getting the message and getting out of the way of danger. In other words, every animal, I'm absolutely convinced that every animal prefers images of the type that I just described. Easier to grasp, faster to discern, is good for life. So I've come back to your question about physics. In the end, everything is about the life of the observer. That is everything in science. The Life of the Observer. It is important to understand faster, meaning to grasp the meaning of what you're observing, number one. That's a beauty. The first thing was to discern the direction of changes. That's also useful for life, because without that, you're totally inept in the effort to improve these many, many things that enable the life of the naked ape, you see. That's the reason why they both belong to us, these two perceptions. And by the way, beauty is not what really what we think that it is as we look at fashion magazines. Beauty is the fact that some images are more attractive than others. And from this comes the secondary title in the book, Beauty Never Dies. The more attractive the image, the longer it is remembered by a civilization. Time, on the other hand, is short-lived. It flies because the human life is so short. But the image of a, say, Mona Lisa or Venus de Milo, the statue, that is immortal because of the beauty that flows from it when one observes it. So all these things are measurable, by the way. You can measure beauty the way I just described, or by the number of visitors in a particular art gallery, or by the number of buyers of a book of art, and so on. And time also is measurable, because clearly changes these days, especially with the tools that we have, is measurable and easy to catalog for further and future examination. So it's really, when you use the word physics, Hassan, people may get the idea that you're talking about extraterrestrial probes and the telescopes and cosmology. No, physics means is really about what we observe. It is about the familiar, the thing that's known to everybody, especially to those who do not go to school. That is physics. It's called nature in the older language. And that nature speaks to the peasant and to the sheep herder nature, to the fisherman. Nature doesn't speak only to the physicist, you see.
We understand from your book, we can also define physics with reference to change, right? So change in the physical world can be defined as maybe physics, right? In that sense.
Well, the problem, I'm sorry, obviously in today's scientific world, you see it in the titles of journals, for reasons that are still obscure to me, students are brought up to think that here is biology that is concerned with living things, and the rest that's not living is called physics. That separation is, in my opinion, false. False. Physics is the biggest imaginable tent of truths called laws that are obeyed by absolutely everything, say gravitational pull or conservation of energy or irreversibility. These are laws of physics, which are obeyed by everything in biology, in economics, in business, in communications, and whatever field you want to bring up. So I don't buy this recent exile of what is not in biology to belong to some other under some other tent. No, in fact, the history of modern science still respects and yes, pays tribute to scientists who were doing natural sciences. They're actually natural scientists, the likes of Euler and Bernoulli and these in the 1700s, Newton himself. These people knew everything. They were polymaths, if you want a better word. And again, I don't know why, I suppose because the number of scientists exploded over the centuries. Natural sciences has arrived in especially in the 20th century in a like a salami that has been sliced already, sliced in about 30 slices. Not just biology and physics, but you know, the slices. I'm not, and by the way, the slices are getting more and more numerous. And the negative aspect of the compartments is that as the numbers grow, meaning the numbers of the scientists, then every single compartment is becomes overpopulated, and that large number of individuals who know one thing and only one thing very well become comfortable talking to themselves. Not talking to colleagues in the other building, or in some other country where this sort of salami slicing did not happen already. So that's why it's important to know the history of everything, especially art and science, and yes, human thought. And you don't have to go to school to learn these things. All you have to do is keep your eyes and ears alert. And that begins with listening to your parents.
Yeah, I bringing up this biology and physics issue, I think it's a good point for my next question, which is a very interesting subject that you have discussed in the book. Why do we feel time flies faster as we get older? I know that you have a very important influential article. You have talks about that, and you have discussed this also in the book. Could you please talk about that a bit? Because you say that the unusual makes us feel that time has slowed down. So if you want to slow down our time, I think there are some things that you suggest also. So why is it so?
Yeah. Okay. If I forget to comment on the unusual, please remind me. But the first part of your question is really the story of how I came up with the explanation. Throughout my life, I observed that time was flying faster as I was growing up. It was definitely that way. And in middle school, I observed that the hour in the classroom was not lasting as long as in elementary school. And then in high school, the hour was even shorter. And then as a basketball player, I paid attention and I noticed that more mature I became, the shorter the basketball game, this observation is very old. Of course, along the way, all the way into my adulthood, but also now in at my current stage in life, this feeling was even more obvious. And then it occurred to me the following: The infant obviously is born not knowing anything. And if you pay attention to the eyes of the tiny baby in the crib, those eyes are clicking and moving in all directions, executing these saccades, observing everything. And of course, the baby cannot talk, but I've been there and I know that those observations are for the purpose of organizing image after image after image in a coherent manner. And this is what the developing brain acquires during daylight, which is when the baby is awake. It acquires a very large number of observations of changes, meaning new images, changes, large number. And now with the body growing, the all the length scales in the body increase. In this case, the path, the length of the path from retina to the brain increases. That's one thing. The number of these, the speed of communication along any flow in the body decreases for many reasons. Complexity increases, but also degradation, also muscular action, the frequency of that decreases as the body size increases. All these effects conspire in one direction, and that direction is that the time between successive clicks increases with age. And that means that at the end of the day, the brain that's already trained to expect a large number of images discovers that when night comes, that number is actually shorter than it used to be. And from that comes the feeling that night has arrived too soon. You see, it isn't that time flies, it is that the future arrived too soon. The next Christmas arrives sooner and sooner the older we get. And that is a feeling that I discovered through correspondence and also input from readers and journalists, that this feeling is universally known and commented on. That is the physics of it. The human body changes, the flows through that body change with age. And by the brain was trained in infancy, and from that comes the impression that you and I have been discussing. The other thing I mentioned already, the feeling of attractiveness comes from the selfish interest of the observer, which is that of grasping the image faster and doing something with it, meaning doing something useful with that message, useful such as running away for safety, or finding a mate faster, or finding a new source of food faster, meaning faster than the competitors. So I'm talking about the prehistoric humans now. And it's just the same thing that I'm discussing or describing about the perception of time. Prehistoric Homo was not looking at the clock. Clocks did not exist. In prehistory, the man was observing that now is different than before. And then recently, when language was acquired by now the highly evolved specimen, words appeared, and the words were not clock. They were now, before, the new or old, these words. And so when many words happen in the language and they all mean the same thing, before we know it, we describe that observation with one word, which is that word is time, or chronos in Greek, or any other old language has this single word that summarizes all these obvious and true observations.
Yeah, it has to do with the standard time and of course mind time, what you call, and I think this is also related to. This is also related to what you said, right? In order to slow down our time, we need to do things unusual or right?
Thank you for the reminder. That's correct. So yes, if you want to impress your aging brains with more clicks during the day, go ahead and treat yourself to changes. This means to make an effort to get away from the routine. Obviously, if you are a couch potatoes, you need to get off the couch. But I'll tell you one thing: if a person is a creative person, then the person doesn't need my advice, because a creative person is, by definition, living a life of one new thing after another new thing. But those who are in domains of activity that are repetitive, then those would benefit if they are concerned about the fact that their lives are flowing faster and faster. Then they would be well served by this advice, which is to take a break and do something different for the moment, or for the half day or the weekend. One doesn't have to be really wealthy to make this effort of change. But yes, the lack of change in the life of the active person can be damaging. I think in the book I gave the example of Stakhanovism, which was a Stalinist technique of breaking records of production, that is by brute labor, by people banging rivets at higher and higher speed all day long. At the end of that, you end up with workers who are suffering from mental illness. That is the destructive direction of the lack of change. So it's not just the fact that life goes faster and faster when you do the same thing to the point that you're forgetting what you're doing when you're doing the same thing. No, it is the fact that you are so engrossed in this virtual world of repetitiveness. You are alone, in fact, with nothing new, that your mind and the mental well-being suffer. So that's basically one of the reasons why this discussion is important. I'll add something else, Hassan.
Sure.
Slowing down the time is not always what the individual needs.
That's right.
If the individual is in prison and is serving, say, 3 years of incarceration or longer, then and obviously the wish to have freedom is in every single one of us, then it would be good for that person to have a life of routine, of no interruptions, of no surprises, so that the gate to freedom opens up faster in his or her mind. So that is also documented in depositions from people who have spent time in prison. So you see, it's not just the one side of the coin that's useful. It's important to possess this golden coin of wisdom and do with it what you think is better for you.
Also, I think that it's not only an individual, it shouldn't be only an individual effort. Sometimes it should be an effort, a social effort, right? Actually, we need that also as part of a society, because now in our society, like, speeding up is a phenomena, and sometimes we need being slowed down collectively, actually.
I'm a modest person. I've seen firsthand the danger of listening to one supreme and all-knowing leader who tells the group what is best for the group. I walk away from that sort of speech. I think it's much better to let the individual, first of all, let him be. Everybody wants to be left alone in order to do the most and the best with what he or she can do. And if you let these people behave in this manner, then you'll be surprised that the behavior of the of one individual is really not much different than that of 1,000 other free individuals. From this emerges the consensus that laws worth obeying, they are called democracy, are worth having and keeping. It is from freedom that the lasting social organization is born, not from the other prescription, which is that of having a even a benevolent ruler who has the idea that you know, everybody should be wearing shoes of the same size. You see, so my observation of why some societies are ahead of others even today is that the diversity of let's call it advancement on the globe today comes from what I described first, which is that if you let people, individuals, find their own ways in freedom, then quietly, without much noise, one discovers that the city arrives at a particular traffic pattern, that the university is born to have a particular organization called hierarchy. Oh, much earlier, the people in the religions found that the hierarchy occurs the same way naturally, without any noise, for the benefit of every single one in the congregation. Yeah, but these are small-scale examples that correspond 100% to the biggest example, which is that of the nation. And a much bigger scale, the military alliance and some other forms of organization that propel society and civilization forward.
Emphasis, like emphasizing on the importance of being individual and making decisions as such. Yeah, we should emphasize that again. Well, by the way, in your book, you deal with some other interesting cases as well. For instance, you talk about something like about literature search, sort of like literature review, so to speak. It was so interesting to me. Well, you are a prolific, of course, writer and scientist. So I'm sure that you do not mean that literature review is bad. Of course not. But I think there's a subtle point here. Could you please explain what you mean by that?
Well, for the audience who decides not to buy this book, which would be a mistake if you don't buy it. The subtle point is the following. In this very, very busy academia, also known as the knowledge industry, and I say industry tongue-in-cheek, there are various patterns that are considered, you know, handed down from the highest prelates, and they are not to be questioned. And one of them is that before you start doing any original research, meaning presumably on your own original idea, you need to do a literature search to make sure that that idea has not been published in the past. To which I say, who cares? Who cares? First of all, it's your idea, the one that you want to study for your doctoral thesis. And first of all, if you engage in this literature search as it is prescribed for the first 6 months of your PhD program, you're wasting your time, number one. You're also dissipating completely your enthusiasm for your own idea. You forget your own idea. And at the end of that search, if you're really dumb enough to execute it, you discover that one or two things. Most likely, that particular idea of yours was not published by anybody. Or if it was published by somebody 300 years ago, it was not exactly what you're talking about, because 300 years ago, the pioneers were the natural scientists I was applauding, who actually knew a lot less than you in this particular narrow domain, but knew a lot more than you more broadly over the entire landscape of ideas. So it was different. The point is that you're wasting your time, and that time is short, where time flies. So I teach my students not to respect this unwritten rule of conducting an exhaustive literature search. If you are a PhD student, worth your name, of course you know quite a bit about the state of your own field. Describe it. It takes you half a day to describe it in your own understanding of that moment, meaning you probably know 10 or 20 references without any effort. And on that background arrives your new idea, which is honestly new and is yours. And it's so beautiful, this idea, that it begs you to jump on it and do something with it, and do it fast, because tomorrow or next week the idea will be forgotten. And ideas are like these birds of spring. If you don't photograph them for the moment, they'll never come back. Much worse. Yeah. Your colleague in the next cubicle is going to steal your idea if you don't work on it and publish it. That's another thing that happens a lot these days in the so-called knowledge industry.
Yeah, that's right. Well, actually, related to that, I would like to ask another question before we conclude our conversation. So then how do you determine subjects on which you do research? Because I'm asking this question because your book clearly shows that your intellectual curiosity and publication have strong connections to your earlier and also ongoing scientific research. So in this respect, would you give us some tips to be a good scientist and thinker at the same time?
Again, I spoke earlier about the fact that when I see a Stalin, I walk the other way. So I'm not telling people what to do. If anything, I encourage my doctoral students, my closest collaborators, to pay attention to the fact that I'm happy with my work, and my work is one of being constantly alerted to the fact that the new ideas are coming from around the corner. They come from questioning, by the way, Hassan. Ideas are not fruit falling from the tree. They happen in the mind of the person who is not so sure. Really not so sure, okay? A person who questions. If I hear something that is not clear, I want to hear it again, and to hear it spoken better so I understand it. If I hear a colleague who was, you know, mixing words that make no sense, I ask, please say it again so that I can understand. My background is modest, you see, Hassan. I was not born in Cambridge, England. I was born in Galați, Romania. So I'm not that good. Explain to me what the heck you're talking about. There are a lot in today's knowledge industry. Most of the narrative is about name dropping and metaphors. People talk about, I don't know what, because I'm not going to criticize anybody. But instead of describing blood and guts in the construction of the animal, they talk about, I don't know what, you know, entropy and the disorder and the death of the universe. Really? I'm talking about the pig. I'm talking about what interests my family, for that matter. So modesty is required also. Skepticism is a medicine you should take to become healthier as a thinker. Don't be too sure, don't be that easy to convince. These people, by the way, the people we respect so much in the history of science, were actually modest. You don't read their complete story of life, but they change their minds all the time. In old age, they would say, I made such and such a mistake. I made this mistake. I should have done that. Yes, of course. They were doing that all along. And what the posterity remembers from them is, yes, just like the beauty that never dies, the best of those ideas. The ones that are, because they are so good, they are most attractive. But just like the paintings of a great master in Paris, people don't know, they have no idea how many rejects that famous painter threw into the garbage, you see. People remember only the one or two or maybe 10 masterpieces. Because the creator, the artist, was constantly correcting himself. Think about that.
Definitely. It's like an ongoing process, actually. Like now.
Yes, of course. I give credit to basketball again. If you think that you're born a genius on the basketball court, you're an idiot. No. You are there in order to be better tomorrow than you are today. If you deviate from that attitude, you'll definitely be out of the game next day. Yes, because everybody around you is in fact on the court with the attitude that they are there to improve and to impress first the coach and then their girlfriends. It's very, very obvious if you know why you're wearing the uniform. So,
it is important, what I can say, like, it is important not to break the chain of sort of like practicing or doing whatever we do, right?
Excellent.
That's
excellent
the important
excellent point.
Point.
Yeah, that's right. Excellent point. Those they're okay. Most of us, okay, I should not be negative here. Let's just say that people I know who find some success fall in love with that single light bulb that came up and do nothing in their lives except repeat the turning on of that light bulb. You know, comparison that, in fact, comes from my father-in-law, was with the comedian who knows only one joke, and but the comedian has to be on stage, you know, to perform, and he keeps repeating the joke, and at the end, in the end, nobody laughs except that he laughs at his own joke. So that is the yeah, that is what goes on, I would say, most of the time in this immensity of participants in the knowledge industry.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I think it's a very valuable, definitely very valuable tip, idea for aspiring students, scientists, thinkers. Just we should, what I understand, we should keep going what we do.
Absolutely. Constantly have fun. You can have fun if you first of all you learn to laugh at yourself, which that is part of questioning yourself, discovering that what you discovered during the night, in the morning it was actually stupid. So you have to you have to start anew, or even better, stop. And then start again, and two days later, this is how the life of the creative person is never dull, because if one idea doesn't fly, maybe if you let it simmer for 2 days, you'll discover that it does fly, provided that you questioned it when it first crashed to the ground, modesty helps, humility helps, humility in the face of yourself, not in the face of some, church leader, you know, humility. Something else now for the young audience that you have, be ready to be rejected, or be ready to discover that you cannot please everybody. Be ready to be comfortable with a signs of disapproval, just like a good basketball player playing in a game in another city. There you only hear boos, not applause. So you're not playing for them. You're playing for your team. You're playing for why you actually came into the sport, which is for yourself and for your fighting brigade, which are your teammates. That has nothing to do with pleasing everybody, every individual in the stands. That's part of, I would say, growing up correctly in science. Modesty, humility, not timidity. I'm talking about skepticism and the clear thinking, and the ability to correct yourself, the ability to question yourself, the willingness to say, I was wrong. You don't have to scream from the rooftops that you're wrong, but to say to yourself, listen, there must be a better way, you see?
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Professor Adrian Bijan, for this stimulating talk, and also, of course, for your book. I'm sure that those interested in those subjects will enjoy reading it. They can find it online on Amazon and other websites, relevant websites. So thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Hassan, and all the best to you and to your audience and to Turkey. Yes.
Thank you so much, I hope we can have other episodes with your new books or research in general.
Keep me in mind. Yes.
Sure. Thank you so much.